This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
And I learned a huge lesson about travel and about what you're putting yourself in a position of when you travel, because you are not in control anymore.
I would go to camp in the summertime, church camp. And then after that, I went to Boy Scout camp.
I mean, I got furious that my people were dying and nobody cared and I could die.
And frequently I would make a turn, go down this road, and something would tell me you're not on the right road.
But when you're traveling, you really have to really listen intuitively at all times. Don't go here. Don't sit there. Don't talk to them. Do go here. Yes, this is the right place.
I was apparently biking through a neighborhood that where only black people lived. And they were really unhappy to see me there.
And everything that you do along the way contributes to whether or not you're going to have a memory that you have to write stories about later to, you know, process.
Hello. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
And from our studio in Sebastopol, California, under the redwood trees and a big Monterey pine and one of those little palm trees that looks like a monster pineapple, we come to you with stories about journeys.
Two stories today, one about high anxiety and another with gastric distress.
Not entirely, however, we will also add in some sensual pleasure and a small amount of enlightenment.
So, this first one comes from a listener's email, and our saying, hey, let's talk. It's one of those stories when you're trying to put stuff together with a theme, you say, what's the theme? Immigrants? Well, she did come from Scotland. Or is it culture clash? Who was I then? Who am I now? Or coming of age? She was 19. Maybe it's a love story. Let's not decide. This is Kim Tripsmith.
So, this is a woman looking back. She's pretty much lived the life of a starving artist. Theater, still walking, singing in rock bands, now with her husband in a Native American music ensemble. She's a mom, she's got a day job, she's just had a story published. But talking to her in a coffee house in Sebastopol, we talked about an old journey. The music you hear has nothing to do with Morocco. It's Kim's music.
Like a sword set in stone, I keep holding on.
We went to Europe when I was 19 with the love of my life at that time, Daniel. He was just a couple years older than me, and we'd saved and scrounged every penny to be able to go over for 6 months. And we had our Eurail pass, and we had invisible ink that we put on it so that when we wanted to change the dates and keep going on the trains, we just took out the old dates and put on the new dates, and that was wonderful, so we got to go forever. Then after Portugal, it was like, well, do you want to go to Morocco? And I was saying earlier that we were reading The Drifters by Michener, and we should have kept reading because when they went to Morocco, they didn't have such a good time. It was exhilarating, though, to be on the Marrakesh Express, you know, singing our Crosby, Stills, and Nash songs and all the way down to Marrakesh, passing to Casablanca. We lost our camera, and this older man that saw that we were quite upset about having our camera stolen took us home with him and into a very tiny, very small house that they were living in the downstairs, building the upstairs, and he showed us every inch of the house, introduced us to his family, and was so proud once again to be able to show, this is my home. Well, we were in Marrakesh, staying at a run-down hotel, as we usually did. And the old city is just as you would expect it. It's the Kasbah, and the tiny little streets. You can't even bring a car through, and donkeys everywhere, and you know, 15 women sitting at teeny little boxes selling the same kind of bread in a row, and 30 men standing in a row that are all blind with their hands out. And every single day, somebody would go and put a penny in the next blind. They would always line up in exactly the same order so that someone who was giving alms to the poor would know who they were supposed to give it to that day. And we both picked up a pretty bad case of dysentery, having eaten the food. And the manager of our hotel told us, oh, you must go to Mount Jabal. It's beautiful valley, Urika Valley. You will love it. It's beautiful. You can camp there. And we thought, oh, this sounds great. What we need is some nature. So, you know, we thanked the manager of the hotel, and the next day we took off and took a big bus to a smaller bus, and then finally they dropped us off in the middle of basically nowhere. And as we were walking up, we met an old man, and his name is Omar. And we asked him in our broken Spanish, English, French, is there a place where we could camp? And he said, 2 days. You camp 2 days across the river. Across the river. So he took us down this path and to the river, and we just put our packs over our heads and thanked him and went across and found a nice little spot and put up our tent. But we were still kind of sick, so rather than getting completely undressed, we kind of left our clothes on, you know, just a t-shirt and shorts, which turned out to be a good thing. What I think to have been about midnight, I woke up and the side of the tent just bowed right into me, just came right into my face. And I thought, oh my God, you know, we're being overrun by cows. And then another side of the tent bowed in, and I suddenly realized, that's not cows, that's a stick. There's somebody on the end of that stick. And as I thought that, my boyfriend pushed up on his arms, and the moment that he pushed up on his arms, the stick smashed down on the crown of his head and split it open. Blood went everywhere. But he was 21, 6'5", strong as an ox, and he grabbed his knife that we always slept with right next to the pillow, and we grabbed the knife, and he just backed up out of that tent screaming bloody murder, and I jumped out of the tent as well next to him, and we looked up, and there was probably 9 men, and they had torches with them that we faced off with, and he started swinging wildly with the knife, and they all scattered. So we ran across the field and then, you know, waded through the river and got back across and ran to this old man's house and said, you know, Omar, what do we do? And he told us in broken French English, hurry, allez, hurry, go back. They mean to kill you, to my boyfriend, and they mean to take you for white slavery, the Angolan War. You know, you'll make a fine prostitute down there. And so if I wasn't already freaked out, now I was definitely totally freaked out. And I had grabbed, as we were running away, I had grabbed our camera bag, which usually housed our passports. But when I looked in the bag, I remembered it was kind of sitting in the open backpack, one of our open backpacks. So I said, I gotta go back and get the passports and the money, I gotta go. So he followed me across the river, you know, saying, wait, you crazy woman, come back here, what are you doing? And I see the men, you know, and they're once again descending upon our tent. And the only word that I knew in Arabic that I'd been using quite a bit for all the street urchins that were always bugging us was emshe, which means be gone. So I start screaming at the top of my lungs, emshe, you know, get away, go, you know. And I moved my hand as if I was, you know, going to cut them open with my knife, which was enough for them to back off again. I turn around to see if Daniel is behind me, and I saw that he had fallen. And what went through my mind was, if he's dead, I am going to totally lose my mind. So I ran onto the tent screaming emshe and just dived into my tent, picked up both packs, and you know, suddenly the person that had a dysentery that could hardly even carry her pack had superhuman adrenaline strength, and I, you know, powered both 55-pound packs across that river, no problem. And then swam back over to see if Daniel was still living. So I just started slapping him. I just started slapping him and splashing him with water and screaming at him, wake up, now is the time. You have to come, you have to be alive. This is the time, please, I love you, wake up. And we fended it off for a while, and then we beat back across the river again to hide in the underbrush. And at that point, the old man, Omar, came and said, Holly, all right, come with me. And he hid us for the night in his barn. My boyfriend was in incredible pain. I mean, a head wound. His head was split about 2 inches right at the crown of his head. And my boyfriend had very, very long, beautiful hair. He was the gorgeous hippie of my dreams from California kind of guy. And I had to cut his beautiful hair, you know, around this wound. It's just bleeding and bleeding and bleeding. I mean, it's just, I'm thinking, my God, he's going to bleed to death. So I finished putting the ointment on, and I just, you know, put these bandages on, and I just stuck my hand to his head, you know, for like 2 hours, just holding it there as if I am the tourniquet, you know. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, you can't sleep, but he's in terrible pain. I have nothing to give him except for, well, of course, we were in Morocco, so of course we had hash. So for the next few hours, I kept my hand on his head. He smoked hash the entire time, and I just prayed. And I'm not religious, but I prayed to every god and goddess that had ever existed on the planet. So about 4:30 in the morning came along, and Omar came back and he said, "You have to leave. You know, I have to live here. And I hope you understand that, you know, I am Berber, and I do not hate you. And, you know, we are not all like this." And, you know, he bowed his head to me, and there was just this understanding in our broken English, broken French, of this amazing bond that had happened between us, because he knew that he had put his life in danger in saving our lives. "Wherever you are, Omar, I still honor you to this day." And we walked out of there into the sunrise at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And we walked our 5 miles back to the taxi stand. And there were no taxis running that day. There was only these buses. And they, threw our gear up on top of the bus next to the chickens. And we sat next to the goats and the rest of the livestock. And it took us to another bus. And we took that horrible bus, you know, up and down the windy roads with buses going 50 million miles an hour. And, you know, And when I went to the pharmacy, I met a French doctor. And the French doctor said, "Oh, you know, don't take him to a hospital in Marrakesh because he will die there. That's for sure. You need to get this man to a Northern European hospital. And I should really take a look at him. You know, why don't you come to my hotel?" So he said, "You know, I'm staying at La Mamounia." And the La Mamounia is the biggest hotel in all of Marrakesh. It's a big pink hotel. And it's very fancy, and all the tour buses stay there. So we go clomping over there, and he's got this, you know, bandage on his head. They didn't like our sandals. So they wouldn't let us in the hotel because of our sandals. So I have a total fit. I get completely hysterical, and I just started screaming at the top of my lungs, you know. And, of course, they called the doctor down. They wouldn't let us go up to the doctor's room. No, we had the wrong shoes. And we looked like hippies. Oh, God. So the doctor came down, and he actually saw us in the waiting room of the hotel. You know, this big, beautiful hotel. Doesn't want us to go upstairs. Okay, in a private room where nobody would see us. Wants us to do this whole operation thing down in the waiting room. Okay, fine. So he shoots him up with some antibiotics, and he, you know, gives me this, and he gives me that, and he looks at it, and he tells me, you know, "This is really serious. Here's a prescription. Here's all the antibiotics I've got, but that's only 2 days' worth. It's going to take you longer than that, most likely, unless you can find a plane to take you there." And I didn't have the money for a plane, didn't have any credit. And I remembered when I was on the train that we had met this guy on a previous train who lived in Fez, who had told me his sister was a nurse. And I had his address. We got to Fez, and I went off to find this guy. I did find him, and he told me, you know, "Well, my sister will be here in a couple hours. Why don't you let her take a look at him?" So she meets him. I give her the prescription. She says, "No problem. I'll be off work at 7. Come and get, you know, the prescription. I'll fill it for you. No problem." And I haven't had a shower at this point for God only knows how long. So the guy tells me, "Oh, you know, there's these incredible baths are right down in the Medina, and I will take you to the baths, to the Turkish baths." So, you know, knock on the door. He says, "Oh, you know, come in for a moment." So I come in for a moment, and he basically tells me in not so broken English, if you don't sleep with me, I'm going to call my sister and tell her you don't need the medicine." And he's telling me this, and I'm backing away from him. Well, I back away, and I back away, and I back into the first room. Well, gee, it's got couches all the way around it. So then I run up the stairs to the top, you know, and he's literally chasing me around the courtyard, yelling, you know, "Your boyfriend will die unless you do me, la, la, la," you know. And I suddenly realized, why am I running from this guy? I am 5'10". I just carried 110 pounds of packs all the way here. I could kill somebody. I am so goddamn strong right now. And so I turned around, and it was very comical. He, like, bumped into me, and I just looked him in the face, and I said, "You call your sister and tell her not to bring me that medicine. I will kill you. It may not be today, and it may not be tomorrow, but you will spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder, because I will not rest until you die." And he looks at me, and he took him a second, and he said, "So, you want shower?" You know, as if nothing had happened. Nothing had happened, right? So we walk out, you know, and we get in the middle of the Medina. And then we took the next train to Tangiers. So we're sitting around trying to figure out what are we going to do for painkiller? We had no painkiller except the hash that he'd been smoking. And, you know, like hell, I was going to, like, smuggle hash across the border out of Morocco, you know, into Europe. And yet I'm looking at my boyfriend, and by this time his whole head is swelling. And the infection is so big that it was literally like you could press down on his forehead like an inch and a half. So I knew I had to do something. So I took the hash and I broke it up into tiny pieces and I put it in my granola. It's true. God is my witness. We ended up smuggling some across the border. The only problem was after that we were never sure if we were smoking hash or we were smoking raisins. But it seemed to work anyway.
On to Madrid, then Paris, then London, where her British passport got him straight into a hospital and pretty much recovered.
One day we went on a really long walk, and we walked and walked. We climbed over this gorgeous rock wall, and we found ourselves at this incredible mansion. And there was this three big ponds with gazebos, you know, next to them. And I said, you know, come on, let's make love in one of the gazebos. It'll be a memory. And so we made love in the gazebo, and we're just putting our clothes on when the gardener comes down. And then we're thinking, oh no, we're trespassing, you know, we're caught. But the gardener was wonderful. And he called us over and started showing us his garden and how his great-grandfather had been the gardener there and his grandfather had been the gardener there. And he showed us every inch of it. And then he went on to tell us how he'd never even been to London. He'd never even been to London. And here we had just been everywhere. We had been everywhere. We'd seen it all. We'd almost gotten killed. We'd experienced the highest highs and the lowest of lows and almost paid the price of our lives in the balance. And then I looked at this man who lived outside of Oxford in Chipping Norton, and I suddenly realized that he didn't need to travel to learn everything, to know what purpose was in life. His gift had been to stay in one place and to have attained a sense of love and enlightenment within that one place. And that because of the way I was raised, having started my life in Scotland and dribbled through the United States, that the travel bug that existed in my heart was voracious and it would never go away. And that I knew I would put my life on the line again, probably quite a few times, in my quest for experience.
And so what do you tell your kids about journeys?
Well, as a mom, I feel that it has been my honor to bring these spirits into the world. And they are my teachers. They teach me every day. I do a lot of theater, so they do a lot of theater. You know, my daughter will be, you know, she's going to be juggling fire by the time she's five. And at the same time, not being attached to the outcome, because it's her journey. Everything I've done in my life has brought them into being. And everything I do from here on and that they do is going to lead them down that path. And all I can do is guide them. And as far as traveling goes, we've traveled quite a bit with my daughter. I sing professionally with my husband, and we've done gigs here and there. And we've taken her to Jamaica, and we've taken her down to Mexico. And she's done countless bizarre festivals and raves and powwows. And so at 4.5 years old, you know, she's seen more than the gardener in England has. So she's got that travel bug, and we'll see where it takes her.
In Sebastopol, California, by way of Morocco, we were talking with Kim Tripsmith.
The music was from Kim's CD, Happily Ever After, with her band Amazon Queen. She's also part of a traditional Native American ensemble, Eagle Spirit. You can contact her through www.monitor.net/tildemamazon. Well, I guess that's the universal tourist nightmare that fuels the industry of guided tours. Like we're thinking, well, what if something actually happens to me?
Well,
there?
It certainly did make me think of the number of times we've had squeaks with our own adventures ourselves.
Yeah, a little less blood, but yes, definitely. Our own first summer in Europe, 1969. 3 months on a motor scooter all over Europe, camping. And so here's another take on first trips. It's fictionalized, but the story is from reality. Day of the Figs.
Oh, God, it's beautiful. Oh,
sun on the waves.
The shimmer.
Well, I've been trying to get you out of here.
Well, Joe, you know, life is
Yeah, the last piece is yours.
Mm.
sushi.
See, I'm kind of slowly working on getting you as serious about me as I am about you.
Like, I don't know if I want to be serious. Maybe I'd rather be entertained. Yeah, that's one thing about my ex. After 20 years, I still giggle at stuff he said.
Now, why do you call him your ex?
Okay, my previously existing husband. Black humor, maybe. He left me for another woman he met in the middle of an intersection. She didn't believe in stoplights.
More wine?
You know, having somebody die on you, people feel that's kind of weird. Whereas ex, that's normal.
Dessert.
What?
Fresh figs.
Oh, look at those suckers.
Mm-hmm.
What?
What? Trina?
Never mind. Never mind. It just brought back a... oh, boy. I'm sorry, Joe.
Well,
maybe it's just too much. Oh, okay. Okay, Joe. In honor of the figs. Scotty and I... Summers of 69, is that when the astronauts landed on the moon?
Yeah.
First time in Europe, the two of us, and we're on a motor scooter, old Lambretta. It lasted through the Netherlands, France, Spain, but in Italy.
So, do you want a fig here?
Mm. Yeah. We were in Firenze, Florence. We were camping. Camps up on a hillside, looking down over history. Crammed full of Italians, since it is Italy. And then they come with their little trailers and their little TV sets, and they're all tuned into the astronauts. The astronauts are going to land on the moon.
The astronauts, yes.
And the day before, we had museumed ourselves and Uffizied and Ponte Vecchioed. But this day, basically what we did was we ate our way across Firenze. No meals. We just cruised and grazed. The day of the figs.
Oh, yeah.
So about halfway across, we tucked into this squid salad. Insalata de calamari. Now, I'd had fried calamari in Spain, so the word squid was magic. But here, no. Oh, God, these were little guys with all of their purpley feet bristled up and serious pepper. And then coffee.
No,
cafe granita. This frozen, beady, slurpy, and gelato. Pistachio, torrone, stracciatella, and, oh, God, lampredotto.
What's that?
Real Florentine blue-collar grub. Like tripe, stomach lining, different part. They slice it in sandwiches, and then they dip the whole thing in broth and pepper. Now, it's not the snazziest Tuscan cuisine. It's not a five-star checking account thing, but for us, it was, an Italian pastry, and cappuccino, and kind of a pizza thing with olives. Hey, are those seals? Or
what?
Rocks? Don't, over there, the round, shiny...
Figs.
Oh, figs. Then the figs. We're on our way back in this narrow little street. The box, and here's this crate in front of a grocery store, and the most spectacular figs the size of lemons. Ripe, juicy, perfect. So we slurped our way down the street. And Scotty was a big guy. He could eat like a horse. Only horses don't eat tentacles and pepper and ice cream and stomach lining or fresh figs.
I love you.
Oh.
I just wanted to slip that in while you're focused on stomach lining.
Well, it's...
Yeah, I know. It's kind of snags you between two worlds.
Well, I don't... Should I finish the story or...
Well, we had better finish the digestive process here, yes.
True. So we puttered back to camp and very anticipatory. And then Scotty started to... He kind of folded his arms across his stomach, and I said something really dumb, like, are you okay? And he said, no, excuse me. And he rumbled up the path. And, well, I was fine. But then suddenly I thought, oh, my God, I was going to wash out our clothes. We can't go another day. They'll crack and fall off. So there was this sink, ridges on the sink, and I had this big stinky block of yellow soap, and wouldn't you know the water was cold. And, oh, poor Scotty, he's gone one tentacle too far. No pleasure goes unpunished. And the squids are playing basketball with the figs.
So you're at the sink, and he's going back and forth up the hill.
Yeah, and up and down the path the TVs are on. It's the moon landing. The moon landing. And it's just, it's something, it's so perfect. Humankind has achieved incredible heights, and Scotty is yarking, and I am scrub-a-dub in the sink, and these dudes are bouncing on the moon.
Our species triumphant, and our blue jeans clean. Oh, Trina. Sweetheart. Trina.
I did not. This is... No. Oh, no, enough of that already. All right. That's Dad. It's X. But now I see the figs in the market, and I look the other way.
Yeah, but they're still full of juice.
Yeah, it's all part of the deal, I guess. Oh, we tasted everything that day. The sweets and the bitters, and the triumph of the species.
So, do you want a fig?
Yeah, Joe. Here. In my mouth. Yes, I do.
That was Day of the Figs, written and performed by us and the Pacific Ocean.
We'd like to thank our daughter, Johanna, who lives in Tuscany now, for our introduction to Lampredotto. For the rest of that food, we really did eat in 1969.
We did. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map, produced by the Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the 70-plus members of the Hitchhikers Guild, and growing. You can become a member. You can send us a story. You can visit our website to listen to past shows, all at www.independenteye.org.
We really want to hear how you like the show and who's listening.
Next week, a Mexican-American's search for what he's searching for.
This is Elizabeth Fuller.
And Conrad Bishop. Peace and joy.
I remember coming into Montreal April 7th, 1967. I remember it very clearly because everything was so big. For a small child from Scotland, I was transfixed by just how much of everything there was. And it still is mind-blowing to go back to Scotland and see how little people live with there. Very small houses, small cars, they don't eat as much. I mean, and yet they're very happy, and they're very proud of what they've got, and they've worked very hard for it. Nobody ever gave them anything, and they're very happy with it. Whereas over here, you know, yeah, I've got this, but I always want more, is the American, you know, attitude, so to speak.